Patricia Camilleri, and in the series called Talking Books, I shall be asking my guests about their personal relationship with the written word. My guest today is Polly March. I'm delighted to have her on the programme. Just a few words about Polly. She was born in Malta to a Maltese father and an English mother. All the best people are half and half, Polly.
As we know.
Polly left Malta to go to school in England at the early age of 7. And her love of acting was born at school, where she had an inspirational drama teacher. So often the case, and goes to show just how important our early teachers are. Eventually she went to Guildhall, and after a period with an architectural design practice, she took up acting again. Her first job was with a marionette theatre, which left her with a deep love of the spoken word and a fascination for the way a voice can travel down strings and make a puppet come alive. Her work has taken her all over England and to France, Germany and the States. Returning to Malta to care for her sister Anne, who had fallen ill, she decided to stay on here, which has been, I must say, a real asset to the Maltese theatrical world. Her recent work has included playing Miss Darbus in a high school musical, Edith in Allo Allo, and she has directed several plays, Laughing Wild, The Alchemist, just to mention two. And coming up in July, as part of the Evenings on Campus festival, the annual MADC Shakespeare, Two Gentlemen of Verona, with an all-female cast and set in the 1980s. I can't wait. Welcome to the programme, Polly.
Thank you, Tricia.
In an interview with Paula Fleury-Sola some time back, she described you as actor, director, drama coach, funny, warm, passionate and articulate. Do you see yourself in that description?
Oh, it's lovely. Yes, I'll remember those words when I'm feeling really sluggish and vile early in the morning. I'm very passionate about words, and I'm very passionate about, what did she say? Articulate. Yes, I search constantly for the correct word, which can be very irritating to some people as I fish around saying, yeah, that's the word.
Well, no, you are definitely very, very articulate, that's for sure. And obviously in your chosen career, that will have stood you in good stead.
Well, yes, except to be fair, actors only say other people's words. And so our job as actors is to try and find the truth of what a playwright was searching for, or what he wanted said, he, she wanted said, and transmute it through our experience and then put it out there. That's all we are, really, recreators. This is another ongoing battle I have with other actors, because I see the craft of acting as reactive rather than creative. It's recreative. Our job is to tell a story, and to tell it as truthfully as we can.
And as far as reading is concerned, when you're alone in your room reading, that relationship that you have with those books, where did it come from? Where was the genesis for that love of yours?
It must go back to being really teeny, because I know from my older sisters that I read very early. And my mother was a passionate reader, my father was, both my sisters are. It's like a, I can't say a drug, because that would mean you're escaping from a present reality, which of course sometimes you are. But I think it must go right back to there. There were always books, always books. I was always encouraged to read a variety of books. And very occasionally when I meet people to whom books are not an essential part of their life, I do wonder about them.
You can't imagine perhaps life without
exactly that, yes. Because you see, to me it's a form of poverty. Poverty isn't about, it isn't merely about lack of worldly goods. Poverty of imagination, poverty of spirit, and to be unaware of your lack is the least wise course, the beginning of wisdom, isn't it, is to know that you don't know.
I asked you about your childhood experiences because the book you've chosen to actually focus on today in this interview is The Little White Horse by Elizabeth Googe, which was written in 1946 and has become a classic.
Yes.
Children's book. But it is a children's book. I mean, obviously with overtones for adults as well. I mean, the metaphors,
yes,
are definitely,
you read it. Yes, full of parables, yes.
At that level as well. You're in good company as for somebody who likes the book, because as I was doing a little bit of research about it, I discovered that it was J.K. Rowling's favourite childhood book. She says, in fact, and I quote, "The Little White Horse was my favourite childhood book. I absolutely adored it. It had a cracking plot. It was scary and romantic in parts, and had a feisty heroine."
Mm-hmm.
Would you echo her sentiments about this book?
Yes, I would. I'm interested that she puts it in the past tense. Obviously, she's moved on. She must have been asked, what was your favourite childhood book? The Little White Horse was my favourite childhood book, and it is a book I return to now as a child. I've got myself trapped in a sentence out of which I cannot get without putting a preposition at the end. It's a book I go back to, and it was probably handed down to me from my sisters, who were a bit older than I was. It gave me, quite apart from the magic and the image of the unicorn, who is the little white horse, there, I've given it away. The little white horse is a unicorn, that magical, elemental creature that seems to embody all our lost hopes and dreams. And quite apart from all that, it gave me an image of what I thought England would be like. There was something very specific. And in all seriousness, I have said to people over the years, I will not die a happy woman until I have a kitchen with blue gingham curtains, salmon pink geraniums, a marmalade cat. What else do I need? A big scrub table and copper pots hanging from the ceiling. I'm nearly there.
And certainly the book has these wonderful images, and we can go into a little bit into the images. And I'd like to take a quote from the book where she says, "For a fleeting instant, Maria thought she saw a little white horse with a flowing mane and tail, head raised, poised, halted in mid-flight, as though it had seen her and was glad." And I thought, although it's not a book I know personally myself, I thought it was probably a bit the embodiment, that sentence, of the feeling that Maria has when she's approaching this new home.
New life, Moonraker Manor.
Describe a little bit the story for those of us who
willingly, and I would urge you not to go and see the film, which I think is called Moonacre, or The Magic of Moonacre, or something. It's not good. So I've heard, because I wouldn't go and see it. Maria Merriweather is an orphan. She is sent to Moonacre Manor. She comes with her governess and a very spoilt little spaniel called Wiggins. And they drive in a carriage. Miss Heliotrope is her governess, that's right. And they have to go through a long dark tunnel to get to the gate of Moonacre Manor. And they are met by a man called Marmaduke Scarlet, who is a general factotum, but he's magical. And she is allotted a tower room with stars on the ceiling, and it's completely round. In this first drive, she catches the glimpse, as you read, of this little white horse, and there is an immediate connection between her and this little white horse. She does not know then that it is a unicorn. and the unicorn stays as a symbol for her of what she needs to achieve, because as we go through the story, we find that there is a great division between the moon Merryweathers and the sun Merryweathers, that, as with all great stories, it is a battle between dark and light, and eventually Maria somehow pulls all the strings together, and it's, the ending is very touching. And if I may, this, my sister before she died was rereading The Little White Horse a great deal, and as she was dying I actually read her the final paragraph, and then I read it again at her funeral, and I'm really proud of myself that I didn't stand there snivelling. I'm probably going to snivel now. But Maria catches a glimpse of the horse two or three times, and very occasionally sees it in a dream. And at the end, she and Robin are married, they've got lots of little children, and they're kneeling in the pew in the local church, village church. And it goes something like, Maria knew that when she was a very, very old woman, she would see the little white horse just once more. And this time, he would not run away from her, but he would come towards her, and she would climb on his back, and he would carry her away, far, far away. She didn't know where, but it was a good place, a place she wanted to be.
Yes, I can just imagine that it was difficult for you to recite that on that occasion, mm-hmm. That's for sure. But certainly the book does fulfill all the prerequisites for the classic children's book. It seems to me that it has this moral strength through it that presumably manages not to be moralizing at the same time.
Not at all. No, it is an adventure story, it is a romance, it is a fantasy, it is about hopes and dreams, and about the need to achieve a balance in life and redemption, which requires forgiveness on the one hand and an acknowledgement of past wrongs on the other hand, which is, and they're both difficult positions to hold. So when you have the blackest of the black Merryweathers eventually having to say, all right, we can live together in amity, give me your hand. So it's quite a big thing for her uncle to take his hand, but they do. And yes, so it's redemptive as well. And I love the fantastical element. I'm very partial to fantasy, and particularly to children's literature, which is the freest of all, because I find that adult fantasy, especially if you move into the realms of science fiction, or it's not a genre I'm terribly happy with, because almost always things are appalling. It's post-nuclear holocaust, everything's terribly dreary. I don't care if it's escapism, I would infinitely rather be reading Tom's Midnight Garden or Henrietta's House than reading that. And then later on there was Ursula Le Guin, there's Alan Garner, there are great, J.K. Rowling, there are great writers of children's fantastical, and I think because children still have this innocent connection.
And they can take the scary, can't they?
Oh, they love the scary. Read that bit again, Mummy. Yes, they love the scary. You left that out.
And the lovely suspension of disbelief, sort of, because you've got talking animals.
Oh, yes.
A real classic.
Yes. Do you know, the one book I never really got on with was Watership Down. Mm. I couldn't be doing with Watership Down. Really.
Why not?
I can't tell you, because I didn't get past page 17. I belong to the page 17 club, you know, people that buy books that because they're on they've won the Booker Prize or whatever. And there is a page 17 club where you stagger through the Captain Corelli's mandolin. I think I'm probably alone in that, but yes, that was another page 17 one.
But otherwise, you like the talking animals in this particular...
Yes, I do, and I'm perfectly happy with things like the Narnia Chronicles, because they are... I suppose you could say that about Watership Down, but they are, to me, an intrinsic part of the story, and because the Chronicles of Narnia are metaphors, parallels, parables...
It has been criticised... for its sort of slightly for its moralizing
the Narnia Chronicles, yes, I think.
Although, I mean, I enjoyed them myself, and certainly didn't analyse them as like that as a child.
Christian apologia, yes, yes, it is. You know, it's important. No, it isn't important. I take that back. It is helpful, or takes you to a deeper level, or another level. If you understand that what Aslan does, what Aslan chooses to do, which is to be a Willem victim and allow the White Queen to have him killed, is a metaphor for Christ's sacrifice. And Aslan says she may know the magic, this is when he comes back again, but she doesn't know the deeper magic. And it is slightly heavier handed, I agree, but it doesn't bother me.
No,
because it's still a rattling good yarn. Exactly. Yes,
exactly. The nastiness sometimes bothered me as a child somehow in the Narnia.
Yes,
the child against child, and I found that slightly worrying. I don't know whether that appears in the Little White Horse, whether there are, I don't know the book well enough to know whether there are children against children.
No, there aren't. Mm. There aren't.
She's on her own, really. And that's part of the story,
yes.
Really, that she
and
is
And then
on
she
her
makes
own.
A friend, and then between them they reconcile the two warring factions of the dark and light Merryweathers.
Mm-hmm. There's also... the lessons, I'm talking about the lessons that a child might learn as they read without even, you know, really understanding it. That one lesson which sort of seems to be inherent in this particular story is the acceptance of the other and the strange and the unattractive.
Yes.
Because if you look through the descriptions of the characters, they are definitely not your... You know, they're not all beautiful
not
white horses
at all.
With manes.
No.
And I think that possibly is one of the very positive messages that comes...
Yes, I think you're right. I hadn't thought about that. But yes, Miss Heliotrope, her governess, little pointy sharp nose, featured sharp voice, always sucking peppermints because she always has, a little pain just there. And even... her uncle, and the Lecoq d'Or. Yes, you're right. And the very frightening dog, Wolf, who is not a dog at all, but a guardian. What Maria does is find underneath these externals. She does acknowledge the need she has of their particular qualities, if that makes sense. Mm. She knows that underneath this sharp-featured, sharp-tongued, acidic lady, she's so acidic that she has to have these peppermints all the time, beats a heart of gold and a staunch, true character. And Miss Heliotrope was disappointed in love, in youth. But it all comes right, which is lovely.
What about the mentor, the parson? How is he presented?
Yes,
his intellectual strength and power.
Yes, he is a man whom his flock love, but they don't understand a word he says. Really, they don't understand. But he has a deep wisdom, and he knows about the seasons. He knows about what's appropriate. He knows what is. What needs to be mined in, you know, dug out of people's character, you know, inside you, Maria, this naughty little girl, you know, which you are sometimes, is this person who is capable of courage and of generosity. the vicar is a wonderful character, and is the lost love of Miss Heliotrope's youth. So guess the happy ending.
And when you look at a book like that, which came out at a period when there was, of course, Enid Blyton, who sort of took the child books by storm, her books are now dated. You wouldn't put Enid Blyton, obviously, never would have put her on the level of a writer like Elizabeth Googe, of course. This book has stood the test of time.
Yes.
It is still being read. Why do you think that is? What has it got, perhaps, that other books, and perhaps even books like Brendan Chase by B.B., these books which were very popular in the 50s, and much recommended, I might say, by parents, why has this one stuck in there?
I suppose it is the... It isn't merely the element of magic, because there's so much more to it than that. The timeless quality, the understanding that there is more to this story than is apparent at first reading. And I think it is intriguing. It's intriguing to wonder why, actually, yes, but I suppose it is because each generation rediscovers a book. Maybe not this one, but a book. And because the themes are about generosity, friendship, kindness, love, that I'm making it sound awfully milky and tepid, and of course those are all quite tough qualities, actually. You need to be quite tough to stay a loving friend sometimes in some circumstances. The adventurous element of needing, of having a task to perform, of having a kind of time constraint on it. Each generation rediscovers it, and I used to read one... I've forgotten the writer. Isn't that irritating? The Woods of Windry and the Stormy Petrel. They were written in the 20s. And they were great. They've disappeared without trace, which is a shame. Disappeared without trace. Mm. But I think each generation rediscovers them. And probably it had a... The Little White Horse may well have had a fallow period. I really didn't know about J.K. Rowling. When you asked me for my favourite book, or at least an inspiring book,
well,
I felt
very... that, I'm sure it went straight back into print.
Well, probably, yes. Yes.
Well, having dipped into it now, I shall definitely be going off to read it
from
cover to cover.
Please do.
Without a doubt. And then we can sort of chat about it again in private. Obviously, children's books isn't the only thing you dip into, and I know that you have a particular penchant for pre-1960 British crime novels.
Oh,
my goodness.
Dear. What a giveaway. What
a
giveaway.
We're moving on here.
Oh, I don't care. Hold your head up with pride, Polly. Yeah. Oh, Marjorie Allingham, Edmund Crispin, Nicholas Blake, Michael Innes, and, interestingly... almost every one of those had another life. Nicholas Blake was C.J. Lewis. Edmund Crispin was Bruce Montgomery. He was a composer of film music. Who else did I think of? Marjorie Allingham was Marjorie Allingham. Dorothy L. Sayers, yep. But they almost all had another life. Michael Innes. Michael Innes is actually J.I.M. Stewart and was Regius Professor of English at Oxford. And
didn't know that.
Yeah. So, you know, they're jolly good writers.
And the other thing you described yourself as when we were first in contact was a serial reader. So you pick up on something
reader.
From the first edition of somebody's writing, and you then read every book they've read until the latest.
Isn't it interesting? Stress, you know, the intonation. You said a serial reader. If you'd have said a serial reader. It means, I think, that I wait for Woman's Own to come out and read the next instalment.
I'm sure that's not what you meant in the email.
No, exactly, but I realise now how it could have been interpreted. Yes, that's exactly that. And it is such a joy to find a writer that I haven't found before. I have 3 or 4 years ago, I discovered Donna Leon. And it was wonderful, because there were 14 others that I could read, instead of having to wait another year for the next one. Yes, my latest is Jasper Ford. I discovered Jasper Ford about 3 years ago, and I'm deeply besotted with Jasper Ford.
I shall have to go and look into
that. Oh, do. He writes of a kind of... I don't know what on earth this makes it sound... What's going on in my head? Fantastical? Escapist? What? He writes about an England that is not quite England as it is now. The major wars or strife, if you like, is not based on economics or land grabbing. It's about literature. So the protagonist, Thursday Next, works for Literatex, and she can book jump. So she can go into books. She goes in to books. Lots of people do. Miss Havisham. Miss Havisham is a very dedicated book jumper and is a great detective and a very wise old bird. And in the first book, The Air Affair, Thursday Next gets into deep trouble because she meets Edward Rochester. And it's all a bit tricky, really, and she ends up changing the end of the book.
That's very postmodern. Anyway, we shall have to finish here, I'm afraid. I'd love to go on talking to you for another half hour. Polly March, thank you very, very much for coming on the programme today.
Thank you. Thank you.
With me today was Polly March. Do join me again next week when I shall be speaking to Mary Darwinian. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.